Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, we're live recording from the 2019 Treefort Music Festival in Boise, Idaho. Whew, what an opportunity for us to come here. I flew in late last night, and I just want to say that we have a live audience today. So after I ask our questions of our guests about their views on different things, we will open the floor for questions to our audience. Well, first of all, I'll say that in doing my research, I learned that Boise, Idaho is ranked number one in the Livability.com 100 best places to live. How about that? Yes. Lots of golf clubs. Pretty exciting. I got in late and I was excited to wake up this morning and try to see the beautiful vista of the foothills of the Rockies. We'll just pretend I got to see them, right, with these cloudy skies. I did pull them up on the phone. I looked at it. Oof, when it nicely lit in that blue sky, I can see why y'all live here. This is pretty nice. But I'm sure it's much more than that of why you guys got ranked the number one livable city. But I think it's a good start. And I want to thank you all for welcoming me to your fine city and this festival. In doing my prep work, I also read that hay, wheat, alfalfa, onions, corn, apples, beef, barley are just some of the increasingly diverse crops grown throughout Idaho. In my short stay, I've already learned that Idaho isn't just all about potatoes. I can relate about the misnomer that a region's lineage can prevent new heritage. So I come from New England. I've been a lifelong New Englander. And I get asked, or you can even ask some of my peers, what it's like to be known about lobsters. But the bigger point is that even if you want to preserve something to be part of what defines you, things are changing and we have to adapt to stay relevant. In Maine, where lobstering has been a $400 million monoculture over the last decade, they've started to diversify. In fact, they've started farming sea kelp, literally farming the seaweed that has always grown on the lines of their pots. In fact, now being invested in a new cash crop that diversifies their outputs and supplements off-season revenue. That's my past private equity talk right there. In these coastal communities, struggling to deal with evolving climate and warming waters, and steeped with more regulations for less open capture or catch available, things have already changed. It's those who are adapting and innovating that can and will survive. It's those that appreciate it's a new playing field and adapt to evolving consumers' interests that will thrive in a new world of necessity and opportunity. Now, I try not to preach too much, so just bear with me a little bit more. We're known that more than just lobsters and fish come out of New England. In fact, many of our communities in New England have been able to preserve their dairies throughout decades of challenges. But that, too, is increasingly becoming more of a struggle, and that, too, has changed. The price of fluid milk in the U.S. is controlled at a federal level. It's a bit like OPEC for dairy. That puts New England dairies at a precarious position. You see, when the penny weight of milk, which is the price per 100 pounds of milk, drops below $21 per, these producers are milking in my area are in the red in every scenario. And the current price of milk is trading well below $17. So things had to change. To stay afloat, Northeast dairies have and had become forced innovators. They've started to differentiate their offerings through adapting their production models to be more in sync with a modern consumer's interests. No growth hormones or no antibiotics ever, and organic milk is another. Grass-fed and now grass-fed from pastured animals living in natural environments is promoted to consumers. Additionally, they've introduced diverse value adds. So cheese, cottage cheese, sour cream, and yogurt, all of these coming from the same animals raised using elevated production standards to have differentiated diverse crop categories. Now may be a good time to explain why and what I'm doing with all of this with Sourcing Matters. You see, most of these stories of the diverse changes and challenges we have within food systems are around exposés and around finger pointing. And we focus the lens in Sourcing Matters on the stories of hope and potential, and mostly on the solutions of change of the great folks that we bring to the table. Things are changing, and for the better. These practices all benefit farmers, animals, consumers, and the environment. It's a systems approach to food system production. In fact, speaking of local dairy, did you know that the largest dairy research institute in the country is opening here in Idaho? They seek to assess and study and introduce solutions for the vast waste stream problem within large dairies. So many of the discussions we find in my area will be happening here in your area. And as we break from monocultures and from shipping our foodstuff an average of 1,800 miles, and we can break from calling our sustenance a commodity like a foodstuff, we'll be having more of these similar discussions about food throughout country and planet. And for those lactose intolerant out there in our audience, maybe dairy isn't your thing. Maybe something else, maybe something local. I've read that Idaho's hop production acreage just went up by 18% in 2018. And they have more than, or you have more than, 8,200 acres in current production. That's a direct result of consumers and brewers seeking something different in beer. The craft brew industry has recently crossed the chasm in sales and reached 13% of the U.S. beer market. How much better is an IPA, from Idaho, sourcing local Zeus hops, maybe someday in the near future, also sourcing the Idaho Kernza wheat, which is a perennial wheat and is very different than our current production model, and local barley. And you know, I said that, I wrote this before I even looked at it, and I was having a coffee this morning, and I'm reading the Idaho Edible magazine, and I see all these advertisements for like completely sourced beer all from Idaho. So just bear with me as I go through my old notes. All right, so that's, either way, it's all better than the average Natty Light in any day of the week. And we've seen it in every other food category with coffee, sweets, savories, wine, beer have all elevated consumers' expectations. So what's next? Is it going to be the center of the plate? Is it going to be the salad plate? Well, we hope so. So yes, on a shrinking planet where consumers are becoming more aware of the impact of their food, things are changing. Maine isn't just about lobsters anymore. New York sources more than apples and milk. And what we're going to learn today is Idaho does more than just potatoes. Today, we welcome two guests who will share stories both up and downstream regarding that change. Today, we welcome chef and food system advocate Chris Komori.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Chris, welcome. Thank you. And farmer and seed propagator Beth Razgorsek. Am I saying that right? Come on.
It's Beth Razgorsek.
Razgorsek, I should have said that.
You're right in there.
With a name like Niederhelmen, I say this often, I try to get it right. Razgorsek. So there you go. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much. Chris, let's start. Yes, please. Chris, let's start with you. With three consecutive James Beard nods, Chris Komori is a rock star of Idaho's chef world, a graduate of the College of Idaho. He sharpened his kitchen skills in Portland before moving to the Gem State. Komori's creative and constantly changing menus drew fast admiration when State and Lemp opened in 2013. The small room seats 22 diners and will share some multi-course fixed price meal. And so this is probably a good opportunity to thank Brett Perry and John Michael Shirt for welcoming me to Idaho. So thank you, gentlemen, for bringing me in. And I bring that up because Chris and Brett and John Michael have had a great relationship regarding their wedding a few years back. Chris was the mastermind behind orchestrating a pretty unique menu offering at their wedding of the century, maybe, I think what people call it. You went layers deep into local sourcing within diverse cuisine. Chris, could you tell us a bit more about what you did with the wedding of the century?
Sure, yeah. We were in charge of the rehearsal dinner, which was great for me, which meant I could just go and enjoy the wedding. They had a pretty ambitious plan, we did collectively, and that was, Brett had been working at Meadowlark Farm in Nampa with Janie Burns, and we were going to do the rehearsal dinner at the farm, and we were hoping that we could source as much as possible from the farm itself. And Janie runs a beautiful but small farm. It's really cool because it's not like rows of vegetables. It's a kind of a more sustainable, self-sufficient farm. The wedding was in June, is that right? So in the area, June is, you know, farms are just starting to take off still, kind of dependent on how the winter's been. So we knew that we had a challenge of getting enough diversity and enough quantity within this small farm in that month to serve 50 plus people. So we actually started to approach it an entire year beforehand. It was a really grand idea, but we learned a lot in the process. I actually went to culinary school in Vermont, so I got a little New England experience. And farming is very integral there. And then I was fortunate that in the restaurants that I worked at in Portland, they were kind of on that cusp of farm to table already. So I had been shown interactions of restaurant to farm, but I had never seen it on the level that we did with their rehearsal. You know, we were out there putting sprouts in the ground. We had chickens that Janie and Brett raised. There's a photo of I think he was maybe a little over one, my son, with the chicks, you know. And so we would go out there every once in a while, and we were going out there and integrated into the farm and saving stuff in August and September and preserving it. And with the plan that, not knowing exactly where it was going to land, but we knew that we had that in our arsenal. And the finished product was something that everyone had put in, you know, and the guests there, we told the story a little bit, but you could really feel it in the crowd, you know, in the diners. And it was a really, really special night, unlike any dinner we've ever done.
If we had known each other, I would have expected an invite at that point, but maybe, you know. The 25th or something like that, right? We'll go back to that. But welcome me to your festival, so that's very nice in itself. Let's talk a bit about that, because John Michael's from the southeast area, right, down in Georgia. So how did you intertwine the local ingredients here in Idaho in the Pacific Northwest with some of those southern roots?
Well, they, collards and okra and so many collards. We would go out there and harvest 30 pounds of collards and put them in coolers, and it was like we never touched it. So we had to figure out ways to preserve that as well, and we actually made kimchi out of it. It's definitely a little deeper and funkier, and the smell of it at the beginning is a little overwhelming, but you know, in a well-ventilated area, it was great. We ended up getting a little bit of char and cook on it because we knew it was such a strong flavor. We decided to just kind of like amplify it even that much more. And yeah, it was a really cool dish.
That's great. Between the beer and the fermented food, you had well-balanced microflora too.
Yeah,
so you're
exactly
looking out for people's best interests as a collective. That's very nice. Chris, I also read that your guests at your restaurant, State & Limp, are seated at two long tables in an intimate restaurant space, and everyone is served the same 5-7 course meal at a price fixed option. I've learned that you call those a one-off menu. Now, obviously, we can't go through the full curation with every patron that we had with John Michael and Brett, but how does the local sourcing influence how you orchestrate your menus at your restaurant?
Sure. So just real quickly, we're not at State & Limp anymore.
Let's update my notes.
Yeah. So we've moved on as a crew.
Okay.
And we're about to open up another restaurant, hopefully in the fall.
Great.
It's called Kin.
Kin.
It's like family. Yeah. And in the meantime, we have a couple bars that are running, Art House and Ampersand. They're fun little projects for us.
Okay. I'll put links on the write-up so
sure,
people can be aware.
The idea of the upcoming restaurant is similar to State & Limp in a way. We will still hold that 24-seat tasting menu, set dishes, and a circulating menu. It'll just have a bar attached to it now. But as far as the inspiration from farms, We kind of evolved into having themed menus, and some of those were based on local artists or you know, the eclipse that happened last year or 2 years ago, and different wildfires and things that kind of happened locally. But the farm is kind of where it started. We have a tendency to not... We have good relationships with the farms. And instead of us calling the farms or calling a produce purveyor and saying, we want this, we want that, we call the farms and ask them what they need to move and what's coming up on the horizon. What we've become is, yeah, definitely a place that we can utilize things that the farm can't sell to potentially a farmer's market or something like that. And so a lot of our dishes are based on the utilization of that and helping them move products.
It's a good way to cue up our next guest, Beth Rezgorshek. Thank you so much for being so patient. You know how us New England guys like to hear ourselves speak so much. So, but hey, thanks for joining us. This is great. And Beth, let's read a bit about your background and then we'll jump into some of the questions. So Beth Rezgorshek has worn many hats, a journalist, a pioneering CSA farmer, flower producer, and now a seed farmer. Today, Rezgorshek grows certified organic vegetable seeds in 7 tillable acres at the Canyon Bounty Farm in Mampa?
Nampa.
I have to check these things. I'll get on this person who writes these notes. Is that right? Where's that guy? Let's get back to him. There you go. Napo. That would be okay. So that you also raise and sell both small seeded and big seeded crops like green beans, dry beans, edamame, various flower seeds, watermelon, muskmelon, peppers, wheat, leeks, and onions. So let's talk about seed propagation and plant breeding. What is it, and how does what you do differ from what everyone knows about genetic engineering?
Mm, wow. Lots of answers to unpack
that,
for you.
Right.
Okay.
Pull that out of the seed bag, right?
Right. Well, just to give Portland another plug, I was farming in Portland as a fresh produce and strictly as a CSA farmer from about 93 to 99, and decided I was ready to move back to my hometown of Napa, and did it. And wasn't sure what I would be doing, but I thought it would be produce, but I decided that produce took a lot of employees. You have to be really big to make any money in produce. That was my first, I guess, something that was revealed to me doing a CSA in Portland. And so I really don't like to manage people. I like to farm. And so I decided that if I moved back to Napa, I didn't think I would do produce, but I had no idea what it would be. I was also paying attention to the National Organic Program, which was being finalized right around 1999, 2000, and saw that they were going to be requesting farmers, organic farmers, to use organic seed. And I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going back to Napa. My family are seed farmers. Maybe this is a good tie-in. And so was able to do just a little bit of fresh produce when I returned to Napa, but then more and more with amazing family support and help, started going into the seed production. And so it was just good timing all around. My dad decided to retire, and I had his almost daily help. And also farming in Portland, everything was pretty much done by hand. And I knew that I wanted to be much more mechanical, and was able to also utilize what my father knew about tractors and cultivators and combines, and was able to kind of tie that together on my small farm in Napa. It was a farm that we were able to buy that I grew up playing on. That was also just a stroke of good luck. And so a farm that I played on is now, you know, my farm. And I'm grateful every day I step out there. I can look down and see the farm that I was raised on. And now I have my own little bit of, you know, my farmland. So I contract. I do strictly contracts on my seeds. So I contract with about 5 to 7 different companies throughout the nation. And it varies every year what it is, what they need. And hopefully it's something that I've grown before. And I don't have to have a big learning curve or a big mystery to me. And most of my seed crops are all, well, all of them are open pollinated. And so that means that, you know, somebody collected that seed eons ago, and somebody has been selecting that seed and looking for certain traits in that seed that are preferable to an organic system, hopefully for flavor. Maybe a little bit of yield is something else that we think about in seed production. And then, so if we, to step back, or if we jump forward from open pollinated, then we can look at hybrid seed. And hybrid seed is basically where you have two parents that are crossed to create something very unique to those two parents. And if you were to take what you have crossed and save that seed and grow it out the next season, it would revert back to one of those parents. It would not be true, like an open pollinated seed would be true. You know, that I have selected that seed and I haven't crossed it with anything and I am saving it, and know that the next season I plant it out, it's going to look 99.9% like what I had harvested the following season or the previous years. Hybrids don't do that. If we jump forward again to like a genetically modified crop, that has been altered in a lab where they physically insert genes into that seed, and those genes have probably been placed there so that they can be resistant to maybe a Roundup or a glyphosate product. And I don't know how much further to take it other than that. But so it's, I don't do any of that, you know, when you're certified organic, you can't even, you know, think about, you know, GMO seeds. They're not allowed in organic farm systems. So that's just a given in organics. And my farm is certified organic. And I can tell you that if I'm growing corn seed and I sell it to a seed company, I can tell you that they're going to be looking for any of that GMO marker in my seed just in case it has been pollinated by my neighbor's seed crop, corn seed crop. So there's ways to look for it. And so there's crops that you just don't want to even go down the road with because, you know, maybe all of my neighbors are growing GMO seed corn or a corn, a GMO corn.
Hmm. Chris, do you have a comment on that? Okay. Yeah, it is interesting, and it's... We've seen a huge movement towards the interest of having naturally propagated seeds and using natural order as our line of demarcation. So we're not manipulating DNA in a petri dish by playing a game of Russian roulette by hoping one sticks to the other. And effectively, that's how we built a lot of the concerns associated to it. And I think a lot of the questions also that people have and that I get often is whose hands are doing the manipulation? And that's really the biggest driving factor of why we're doing that. Hybridization and seed stock is actually an area that is, I think, a burgeoning space in an innovation economy. What's happening in Svalbard, which is up in the upper regions of Norway, where they have a global seed bank. They store 900,000 seed types. 200,000 individual wheat seeds alone are being stored. These are natural seeds that have propagated throughout the world, and we don't even have any idea of what makes sense and what's up there. Do you have a comment about that? No.
I think it's a pretty rich repository of, you know, of seed. You know, whether, you know, they're putting seed there when countries go to war, they'll just take and put some seed stocks in there. So it's a nice fallback. You know, if I were more of a seed breeder, I would be dipping into that.
Yeah. In our initial conversation, you shared some of the work of the Culinary Breeding Network, which stems from the idea that plant breeders, farmers, buyers, chefs, and distributors and eaters have a lot to teach one another. The Culinary Breeding Network aims to break down the walls between eaters and breeders by offering unique opportunities to see the tastes and new in-development vegetables, grain cultivars, shared options, and an active participant in the breeding process. So as a farmer and a breeder, why is this program so important?
This is a program, the Culinary Breeding Network. It's it was created from a wonderful woman at Oregon State University. And I wish I knew more about her story, but she saw that chefs and seed breeders and seed people probably shared more common ground than we could even imagine. And it's a focus on flavor as well as what works well in the kitchen for a chef. And so it's, I just thought it made so much sense because as a seed producer, I have been given crops to grow on contract and they are duds. They don't taste good. They don't produce well. And I'm wondering, just because this is a crop that's over 50 years old, it's not worth it when I see there are other options out there. And same thing with other crops I've grown. And I wonder, why don't chefs know about this? Because this is an awesome crop or a plant in my field under organic growing conditions. And the flavor is beyond anything I've ever tasted. And, another one is a pepper, actually it's a Basque pepper, I call it piquillo, and it's a smooth-walled sweet pepper, and it peels in one peel after you grill it and, roast it. And I'm like, this is a beautiful thing, It's like people need to know about this, And it tastes good. It produces well in our climate here. So I just think it's a great marriage of many different things about food, starting with a seed.
Yeah, I actually have a connection to them as well. I have a friend who is now a member of theirs, Tim Wastel, and I used to cook with him. And he's actually employed by Oregon State now through the program. And I had a conversation with him about it to learn a little bit more. And it's an amazing program because it's an educational thing for chefs. Restaurants and the role of a chef is changing. The role of restaurants is changing. We need to support local farms as best we can in organic produce. But there's a cost issue with it. The consumer is only going to pay so much for the food. Local food does cost more. And so restaurants have to figure out how to manage that. There's a marketing side to it now, but at the end of the day, sometimes it's cost prohibitive. Now, what Tim was mentioning about what some of the things that they're working on is breeding for longevity of cellaring winter squashes. Going back to the pepper is interesting because they're talking about more square peppers to a certain degree. Ones that are have less curvature in it. That's part of the peeling issue, right? So from the restaurant's perspective, not only are you getting flavor, but you're getting a better yield out of it. So it costs more, you're not buying in as much. And that's an interesting way of looking at, like, flavor is great and that's going to drive ultimately, but we need to make sure that we're running our numbers correctly in order to be a successful business. And that's why it's hitting different prongs of the problem. So it's really exciting, and I would love for it to kind of be flooding this way a little bit more too.
There's, you can, I think besides the chefs, there's also the gardener and the consumers, the people who are in everybody's kitchens, who need to know that sometimes there's something a little bit more special out there, and it doesn't cost any more to grow a piquillo pepper than it would, say, a bell pepper in terms of what I see in yield and production, the handling of it from a farm side. But until we have a means to communicate what's different and what's exciting out there, and that's what I like about the Culinary Breeding Network is that it kind of became a showcase that was more focused on the chefs and the breeders, and now it's become more of a public event. And I think that's also exciting too, because then we can talk to gardeners about it as well.
all exciting evolutions. And I think, as you both have mentioned, it all starts with taste. If it tastes poorly, it's tough to swallow the right thing to do. So the fact that it tastes better, that there's a lot of associated values to this, the things that like shelf life stable, we've seen it in things that we probably aren't even as aware of consumers when you go look at different produce offerings or apples. How come the introduction of the Honey Crisp has come out of nowhere in the last 5 years? Because it has a great taste that it holds values over a long period of time, stores well, can be grown in many regions, and so it deserves a price premium as things continue. So I think those are exciting evolutions as we get some of the rock stars in our food systems, like the chefs, to gauge and engage with the other stakeholders involved in the program, including us, the consumers, to be a major part of that. Chris, I want to return back to you and ask you about minimum wage, which has become a hot button issue in this country. It's a bit of a political football that will come back to the mainstream as campaign cycles ramp up again. So I understand social fairness and restaurant workers is a driving factor for you. And in fact, you were quoted as a few times discussing fair trade practices for all stakeholders in food. What do you do to get a fair living wage for your workers and suppliers?
Well,
it's all on you, Chris.
Yeah, we are working on it. We're having conversations with other restaurants. We're making it a little bit more out in the open. I mean, a big issue is, well, there's a couple. The Boise restaurant industry, like a lot of cities, there's an issue with the talent pool and retaining of cooks. Not just within our restaurant specifically, but to lose young cooks to larger cities. Part of it is good. They need to go out and they need to get that experience in big places, big restaurants. But we're missing out on the talent pool a little bit. So we look at it as not just a sustainability for them, but we need to retain our staff within the city, within our restaurant. It costs a lot to be constantly retraining people. I mean, that's across other industries, but in kitchens, very much so. I mean, especially for us, because our restaurant is a little bit different and we kind of have a system that is unique to us. So once they get trained up, they're pretty self-sustainable, but that takes a long time. The other side of it is, you know, we want being in a restaurant to be a career. You know, I understand that there's going to be a large portion of people that it's a college job or you're kind of in transition going from one thing to the other, but we want to legitimize it as an industry. And we can't do that unless we pay better and make it something that a cook can live off of. So, I mean, there's issues because restaurants are notoriously difficult financially. You're battling percentages, you know, small percentages, and that's success or failure there. But we need to look at it like we need to invest in our employees more in order to retain them, keep them happy, give them a sustainable life. And we see the benefits of that. Definitely. We already have. We are at State and Lemp, we had a kitchen that we lost maybe one person in 4.5 years. And that's pretty unheard of in kitchens. And not only that, but then we left State and Lemp and our team is still together. And we're kind of just like treading water, floating out there, and they're still with us, you know. Wow. And there's a loyalty around that. And that's really the basis of why we want to work on employee wage and everything like that.
Yeah, I would say that is definitely an anomaly in the space that you've had that many people come with you and are waiting for the next. That's mm-hmm. exciting. So, Beth, similarly for you, consumers seem to be well aware of things like fair trade practices for coffee and chocolate that we source from all over the world. In fact, it's one of the variables we use in coffee is we all recognize the logo of fair trade on many of those practices or products we buy. But how do we get better involved in making sure that our apples and dairy and potatoes from Idaho also provide good working conditions and a living wage for our neighbors that are producing them? Do we have to buy everything at a local farmer's market?
There are some people here who say, sure. but I, to be honest, I really don't shop at a farmer's market. Mainly because I have a field full of produce and I don't need to do that. But, you know, I wish that there was a farmer's market in my community that had organic vendors, because I feel like if you are purchasing from a certified organic producer, I'm also hoping, and I'm also making some assumptions here, that they have a fairly decent relationship with their employees. That's a tough one. I don't know that I'm going to give you an adequate answer. It's hard. It is really hard. You know, in my family, I have a brother who's a really significant scale up farmer, and I know he takes awesome care of his employees. You know, I know what they get paid per hour, and I can't even go there with that wage that he pays them. But he expects a lot of them. They're year-round. Most of them are year-round employees. He keeps them busy year-round. So, and he is not an organic farmer, but he takes very good care of them. So it's a mixed bag out there. And I wish that there was some way, you know, there used to be some systems out there that employees and working conditions were some of the checkoff boxes. And I have not kept up on that, in all honesty.
No, it's fair. And I, to your point, I don't think anyone has a great answer for it, especially within our regional food systems. It's part of what causes food to cost more is that we're paying people a livable wage all the way up the vertical integration of that. And that is a challenge. And the fact that in this country we spend 5 to 6% of our discretionary income on our food systems is a problem. Some of parts of the country embrace that as, look what we've been able to do. Look how we've modernized a food system. Whereas others were realizing, wait a minute, by the way, we also have 18% of our GDP that goes to reactionary healthcare. And look what's happening with the depletion of our natural resources. So it's an interesting time that we're coming to a culmination. And while I get excited, and by talking to individuals around the country in different rooms and different experts, is by then hearing from people that it's the consumer that's the change agent. And the more that we get involved, we can develop economies of scale. We can develop it so that it's not a twice or three times 3x price premium, but if this becomes part of a opportunity where we can start to scale out production, we have better distribution models, better cold chain practices, better sourcing with our chefs who become advocates in these type of programs like Chris has, I think those are exciting evolutions. We've seen them in pockets, right? Idaho might be a pocket, or Boise might be a pocket. The Northeast surely is a petri dish. But this is penetrating across a much broader swath. And I think the next step is when we get into a federal level, right? Then we'll see some progress. But I'm not holding my breath. How's that? All right, so let's do this. Let's open it up for audience questions. Does anyone have a question for our two fine guests or myself? Brett?
I have a quick question. Beth, when you're raising your crops for seeds, what happens to the plant post-production? Is there a conversation? I mean, I know it's probably past its best flavor and its best nutrients. Can you kind of explain the process of what happens to the plant? Is there any conversation with the restaurant industry on
I'm just going to repeat the question so the listening audience on tape can hear it. Great question about after we propagate the seeds out of your crop, what happens to the rest of the carcass utilization? There you go. That phone call is from me. I'll take it and I'm done. Beth, do you want to?
Right. So, I can grow 12 to 15 different seed crops in a year, and they each have a different harvest method and a timing for when that seed is ready. And that's a good segue into, I did bring some cucumber seed to share with everybody. It's right here in this basket. Feel free to pass it around and take some if you are a cucumber fan. So cucumbers, just to highlight this, is that cucumbers, the seed is only ripe way beyond when you would ever want to eat the cucumber. It's gigantic. It's probably 3 to 4 times bigger than how Chris would want to serve it in his restaurant. It's buckskin, and it's just a nasty, gnarly mess. And you know, I use some equipment to crush it. The one crop that I do grow a lot of is a sweet bell pepper. that I've been growing for years. And I used to have big parties, and I would invite all my friends to come, and we would just harvest hundreds and hundreds of pounds of bell peppers, and then friends would just help me take the seed out, and then they could take the bell pepper. These are red bell peppers, and they would take the bell peppers home and stash them in their freezers or puree them, whatever they do with them. And that's been great. And I used to do that with restaurants. I used to have this really crazy network of taking peppers to the chefs, and then they would take this, they would keep the seeds for me, and then I would come back, get the seeds, and then they would have the bell peppers to use. And some of the chefs even froze them, which I thought was, I just thought that was brilliant. But it just got complicated, especially now with the new produce laws, the fresh produce laws. I just didn't want to go down that road of being inspected for doing fresh produce on my farm. I have inspectors on my farm enough as it is, and pay plenty of fees for those. And I just decided that I'm just going to crush the peppers, extract the seed, feed them to the chickens. I get nice red egg yolks. You know, give it back to the earth. That's another way, compost as well. And so that's how I do it. A long time ago, we used to have watermelon seeding parties as well. And so, but watermelon is actually one of those crops where the seed is better after the fruit is beyond how we would enjoy the fruit. Wheat is pretty straightforward. It's just wheat berries. So, you know, I get the benefit of a great crop rotation with wheat. So it just varies. And that kind of gives you the range of things.
Full carcass utilization on a produce farm. So there you go. Question.
So you talked about consumers being sort of the agents of change. As two people who occupy sort of different spots within the supply chain, what is one concept or idea or fact that you wish consumers knew and understood as they were consuming food?
How can consumers become much more aware of their part in this?
I think that it's a lot like a lot of other consumer products. It's a little bit of work because you have to research into the process. You know, you have to research the place. So, for instance, a restaurant. You're going to pay a higher premium to come into our restaurant than to go to an Applebee's or a chain place. But also, so much of that is the product that we start with. I think that that's kind of something that people inherently know. But when you see a menu, a lot of times you get sticker shock, and there's just something associated with seeing a price at a certain point, and you just say, "Well, I'm never going to pay for that." What needs to be understood is that it's a labor issue. If you want a good product to eat, it's going to cost that because it costs the restaurant that much more to get that good product in. Each restaurant will kind of look at that differently, but I think there just needs to be a little bit more of an understanding of how much it actually costs to provide that food.
Beth, yeah.
I think for me that being an organic seed farmer, organic seed is suited to your organic garden. It truly is. It has not been grown with high inputs, and high inputs would be things like your fertilizer and your pesticides, you know, and so it's so much more well suited for your garden and for your growing conditions. And so that's why organic seed has a value that it does. It will just naturally respond better. And I had to learn this the hard way. I grew conventional wheat, trying to find the perfect wheat for, at that time I had a flour mill and a flour business. And I bought conventional wheat, and it just did not respond to my organic fertilizer to get the protein that I needed in that wheat. And so I should have known better, but of course, until you try it, all things are possible. So organic seed for organic gardens really does respond well.
A different operating system, right, raising these. So you had a question, then we'll come over here.
So you said you contract with 5 to 7
No, I mean, they could maybe buy it from that company, and then it gets brought back into the into this state. That? No, I do not. I do not.
You had a question? Chris, how do you cut through the fluff and people giving you the greenwashing on their menu, whereas you're doing it the right way?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question because as far as I know, I don't think there's like a policing squad that busts into kitchens and walks through their walk-in. I mean, that'd be great because we'd have nothing to hide. Part of it is going to be, from the consumer's perspective, it's an educational thing of actually understanding the seasons. You know, if you walk through the farmer's market and you see certain things, and only those things, potentially, and then you go into a restaurant and they have tomatoes in January, I mean, there's hothouse ones, sure, but if they're saying that they're from specific farms, you know, there's probably something up with that. A little bit of it is the chicken wings, right? So, I mean, your chicken has two wings. When you get 12 wings on a plate, that's six chickens, and where's everything else going? You know, so it's not just a produce thing for restaurants. A lot of it is the animal side of it, and again, and that's a huge utilization issue. I guess the answer would be, you gotta be inquisitive, and you have to ask, and you have to just be thoughtful about it too. You know, like question certain things on a menu. Now, some places you go in, they're gonna have the same menu all year round, and that pretty much answers that. It is a tricky thing because it is a buzzword. It is something that the consumer already is kind of wanting, but it's not thinking about where if it's actually happening. You just read local and then you leave it at that. But it takes that next step up, I think. So
it's like the John Madden turkey back in the day of the Thanksgiving Day when you have 12 different legs on that turkey. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
There you go. Other questions? I think we have time for two more. Yes.
Hey, I was wondering, so between a farmer and a chef relationship, what kind of standards do you look for when you develop that symbiotic relationship? Do you have red flags that go up saying you don't want to work with that farmer or work with that chef necessarily? Because they're throwing around the words a lot of fair trade, worker conditions, organic. So there's certain things that you hold yourself accountable for your restaurant or for your farm, and does that matter with your contracts, and has that gone awry ever before?
So what standards do you as a producer and a chef hold to? So great question.
Obviously, for me, if I've taken seed from a seed company and it didn't come true, that gives me pause if I ever want to work with that company again, because then I know that if this lot was contaminated or not consistent enough, let's say for a muskmelon, does that mean the other lots are just as challenging? And is it my job to clean up that lot as well? So, and if I'm not getting paid to clean it up, and if I'm just getting paid as a straight producer of the seed, then maybe I need to think about my relationship with that company.
Regarding our relationship with the smaller local farms, it's a lot of give and take. You know, it's a lot of communication and letting go of certain things. We've been learning that. I've been learning that specifically. Like, at first, we were looking for a product to be a certain way. You know, we wanted that beautiful everything. And there's a disappointment when it's not that, or when you order something and then you get half the amount. That's a tricky thing. You have to be able to adapt to that. But also, what we've been able to develop with the farms is a genuine relationship where we give them we cut them a little slack, you know, but it's communication. It's getting ahead of it and calling in a couple weeks before or a week before and saying, like, you know, we noticed that the frost is coming. What's happening out there? You know, every farm is at a different elevation. They all get hit differently. So it's just like constantly communicating with them. A large part of it that they now trust us, and we kind of threw our hat in the ring first and said to a lot of farms, like, we'll design a dish, a menu. We're not a huge place, but we'll do as much as we can with the product that you're losing or that you can't sell at the market or something like that. For instance, at Fiddler's Green, we went out there and we were going to do a dinner, and we just happened to like see a tractor that was about to till over something, and we were like, well, what's out there, you know? And there were secondary growth of cabbages and things like that that we were able to pluck off and use. And then we looked and there were carrots in the ground still, and they said that the carrot had like a little bug kind of like digging on the outside, kind of making them ugly, but the carrot itself was still fine, but they couldn't sell it anywhere. So they were just actually going to till through it because it was going to be less work and less money for them. So we went out there ourselves and harvested, and that's like not a sustainable thing for us to do, but we went out there and did it, you know, and we did pay them for a portion of the product. And not only that, but we were still using it, you know, and we've had a lot of cool dishes and even drinks at our bar that have come from that. So we've seen a creative light from it. But what the farm saw from us was that we had their back, you know, and we were helping them generate revenue from something that they thought they were going to lose. So now those guys we're the first ones that they call when they have a cool new product, you know? And so there's that relationship, and it just takes being true and work too, so.
Well, that's great. I will just close by saying it has been a wonderful opportunity to come out to Boise and learn a bit more about your agricultural models, about your interest as consumers. And I'll say it's not that much different than what I deal with in the Northeast or we learned in the Southeast. I think we're coming to really a unified effort that food can be an opportunity and a change agent where we're involved in looking at environmental issues, ethical treatment of workers, humane treatment of animals. All these things are really starting to be intertwined into our future food system. And as technologies and awareness and appreciation tie with that and give us a chance as consumers to know really what we are buying, where we're spending and dedicating a little more resources to, it's a lot easier to understand and be appreciative that those values do matter. And in food, it matters greatly. And as we say in the podcast, sourcing does matter. So there you go. So Beth Rezgorshek, thank you so much for taking the time to partake in today's conversation. And Chris Komori, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you to our live audience. It has been a wonderful opportunity to speak in front of you. So thank you.